This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
The 10-Minute Timeout is a mini podcast that brings Mississippi sports stories to life. Join me, Lacey Alexander, as I learn more about the teams, athletes, staff, and programs that make our state proud. One-on-one interviews with influential playmakers paint a clear picture for listeners of how Mississippi sports inspire and energize our community. New episodes released every other Friday on your favorite podcasting app.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Creature Comforts, the show all about your animals and the animals around you. I'm Kevin Farrell, here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson. Libby Hartfield, retired director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Sciences, out this week. The past couple of weeks, we've talked about all kinds of birds on the show, but somehow never managed to talk much about waterfowl. With all the wetlands in Mississippi, we're home to many birds that soar from the sky down into the water. So our guest today is the Waterfowl Program Coordinator for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. We'll be talking with Houston Havens. Also, Dr. Major will be on the line ready to answer your pet questions. So join our conversation this morning. You can email animals@mpbonline.org. And if you miss Creature Comforts on Thursday, I want to remind you that it repeats every Saturday morning at 6. So good morning, Dr. Major. Let's start with you. You know, I think it was last week we were talking a little bit about some of the birds that you see in the clinic, and sometimes they're quite chatty. What type of birds do you usually see in the clinic?
Well, of course, here at the clinic we do have two birds that are residents. Chester is a double yellowhead Amazon, and he is pretty chatty at certain times of the day. He has wide vocabulary, and you have to kind of stop and think sometimes what he's saying. But he is. And then we have a small bird, which is a Senegal parrot, which is probably about the size of maybe a robin, give or take. So just to give you an idea. And basically, he whistles. Every once in a while, they say he said the word, but I'm not so sure. He whistles, though, kind of a little shrill whistle. And can, if you're standing there, it can kind of hurt your ear almost when he does that. But as far as other birds that we do see a fair number of Amazon parrots. We see a lot of times we see, I guess you would say, wild birds that have been injured, either running into a window or a car, and we can certainly try to rehabilitate those to a certain extent, but we would try to refer them to a rehabber that's equipped and licensed to take care of them. I guess we've seen just about any kind of bird you can imagine, chickens. Some people have pet chickens. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's a fair number of people that have certainly want the eggs that chickens can provide. You know, just to have a supply of eggs would be a constant thing. So, you know, as far as a lot of exotic birds, we're not in an area where we have a lot of different parrots. Usually they're fairly common. And we see the small budgerigars or parakeets. They still are fairly popular.
So the parrots have a fairly long lifespan, don't they?
Yes. I've had Chester since he was, right out of the egg almost, maybe a little bit more than that. But he's around 42, 43 years old.
Wow.
And they have a lifespan, I expect, if you look it up, would be somewhere in the 60 to 70-year range. There have been cases where there are some parrots that are older. Some of that's undocumented, but there's been some that they said lived almost to 100 years. The smaller birds don't have as long a lifespan. For example, the little Senegal parrot that we have, somebody brought him to the clinic, I believe it was 1989, he had been biting the kids or whatever, and he's a sweet little bird. His name is Mr. Bird, or just Bird for short. The lifespan, if you look that up, is around 25 years, but we've had him since 89, so if you figure that up, I tell him every once in a while that he's reached his expiration code, but he doesn't pay any attention to that.
So do these birds, the parrots and things that talk, do we have any idea whether they know what they're saying, or is it maybe they gauge the reaction and so they know if I say this, I'm going to get this kind of reaction?
Yes and no. There's been a lot of studies done with African gray parrots, and they have a really wide vocabulary. And I have an African gray at home, and he's not real talkative, but you can hear him talking to himself a lot of times. He can also mimic my voice, the dog's barking, a sneeze. He can do sneezes. In Chester's case, he knows when it's quitting time, and he'll start saying bye-bye. And when he wants attention, he'll say, "Polly, want a cracker?" Otherwise, he might not shut up. In answer to that question, if you rattle your keys like you're leaving, he'll be saying bye-bye. So there is some prompts, and they can actually know what they're saying, I believe.
And
not
again,
always. They're mimics, yes, but they actually have some relationship to certain stimuli that they know, okay?
And do most parrot owners try to teach their birds what to say, or do the birds just pick up what they're hearing maybe in the house or whatever?
You know, that's true. A lot of people will try, and they can be successful. There are tapes and CDs on teaching your bird to do certain things. Some of it's really amazing. I can remember years ago a little parakeet that could actually whistle and say a lot of the words to happy birthday, and it was very evident that that's what he was saying. So that is more learned either from video tapes or just constant working with the bird. In our African gray at home, you know, we always kind of say, "Mr. Bird," he's named Mr. Bird as well. "Who's the best bird?" And he can say, "Why, it's me, Mr. Bird. That's who." But then he'll be mumbling to himself sometime early in the morning. And I can hear him, he's carrying on a conversation with himself. We try to leave a TV going during the day with some animal channels rather than anything too violent. I don't know that he cares, probably, but it's good to have something when everybody's gone from home.
So an older bird kind of mumbling to himself, that sounds like maybe some of us humans as well.
probably so, but he'll be saying, of course, he likes cheese, and he says, "Want cheese?" Occasionally when we see somebody preparing food. But he's you know, a lot of it has to do with the time that you have to spend with the bird, and that is important if you're selecting a bird or a parrot, larger bird, that you spend some time with them and they don't become cage crazy, that sort of thing. Any type of animal that you saw an excellent thing on dogs the other day that was talking about the hunting breeds, the herding breeds, and you select one of these dogs because they look good, but then they're confined to the house all the day when everybody's gone. So, yes, they can have some developmental problems and some bad behavior. It's more that they're anxious and don't have enough to do.
Let's talk about if folks are maybe thinking of getting a parrot or a parakeet or any sort of bird that they will keep in their house. What are some reminders to make sure that the birds stay safe?
Well, a lot of people will let their birds wander around the house, fly around the house. You have to be careful with ceiling fans, especially if you don't keep the wings trimmed back where they can't really fly at any height. Birds like to play with toys, and sometimes they will play with a small toy. I had one case where a parrot developed a fistula, which is an opening from, in this case, from the crop of which birds have. And was draining, and it came from eating a small toy and could not pass that, and it actually ruptured through. So be careful with the toys. They have a plethora of toys that are available for parents, and you like to enhance their ability, if you will. And if you have the time, certainly you can teach enough that everybody dance and do all these crazy head motions, and certainly if you stimulate them, they can learn, and that is one thing that's important. But a lot of times people purchase a bird and really don't have the time to take care of it, and it becomes kind of hard to handle. It may become destructive if you have it out. I can remember one cockatoo that ate the edges off of an expensive dining table. They weren't watching what he was doing. He just went down the edge of the dining table and peeled it off. So just be aware. Do your research just like you would be doing research on a dog or a cat or any other animal, and be sure that you're able to provide a good environment and able to take care of it safely.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think always if you're thinking about introducing any sort of animal creature to your home, do some research so you get a good fit for both you and for the dog, the cat, the bird, or whatever. What about, I know I once knew a family owned a bird and they had like a curtain. Is it a good idea to have the bird maybe have some private time to itself?
It's important to have some darkness. They recommend 8 hours, maybe put a cover over the cage, but don't have the bird where it is directly exposed to light 24 hours a day. Sometimes a street light or a night light would be on in that room, so it's good. Just take a blanket and cover the cage. But they would do better having some time when it is dark, and that just helps with the normal rhythm of the life cycle. But yes, they need some rest. And the other thing would be if they're in a, like if it's real cold and they're next to a window, you can get a lot of convection type of movement of air, and it can be quite cold, so it wouldn't hurt to have a blanket to at least protect, or something over the cage that would protect that bird.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we will begin our discussion with our guest for the hour. He's the Waterfowl Program Coordinator for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. We'll be visiting with Houston Havens. Also, Dr. Major will stay on the line from his clinic in Jackson, ready for your pet questions. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, you can email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. We're back on Creature Comforts. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson. If you want to join our conversation this morning with a question or comment, you can email animals@mpbonline.org. As I mentioned in the top of the show, our guest for this hour is Houston Havens. He's the Waterfowl Program Coordinator for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. Well, Houston, first of all, thanks for coming in and joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how long have you been with MDWFP?
In a couple of weeks, it'll be 17 years. That's hard to believe.
Very good. So we always like to ask folks to come on the show, just kind of your inspiration for becoming a biologist and a waterfowl biologist. Were you someone who kind of was always out enjoying nature as a kid?
Absolutely. Born and raised in Mississippi, grew up in rural part of the state and still live there today. And just getting out, I was always trying to be outside anytime I could when I was a kid. That passion stayed with me as I got into high school and went to junior college. Initially wanted to be a veterinarian and, started to learn about Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, and that there was such a career as a wildlife biologist. And I thought, well, that fits a little more of my interest. And so went to Mississippi State University and then came into this job straight out of my time there.
So in addition to your long tenure, I guess the education that you got helped out. Again, tell us a little bit about the education portion of your resume.
Yeah, so started at a junior college to knock out some of the basic coursework, and a very big advocate for our junior college system here in the state of Mississippi. Very science-based and statistics-based curriculum. Once I got into my bachelor's and master's degrees, those classes take up the most of your time. A lot of the biology science courses have lab portions of those courses, and that was just tremendously interesting to me to go out and do field exercises that were associated with the curriculum that we were, sitting in a classroom and learning. Of course, the classroom is a big part of any degree in college, but getting out and seeing those hands-on experiences, having those experiences was a really big part of it for me.
And did you find out that some of that stuff that you did in your lab work in college were the things that you're now doing in your job?
Absolutely. Learning about how we survey wildlife populations and track how populations are doing was a really big part of it. trapping wildlife, banding, things like that was very interesting coming through our coursework here. And then I was one of those lucky individuals who ended up getting a career that was able to do some of those activities for my day-to-day job.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio, and our guest for this hour is Houston Havens, the Waterfowl Program Coordinator for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. So if you would give us maybe a snapshot, some of the things that you do on the day-to-day basis as the Waterfowl Program Coordinator.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about being a wildlife biologist is the activities are very seasonal, so you're not doing the same thing every day. And, you know, some people may not like that aspect of a job, but it's very appealing to me. This time of year, we're getting into the growing season, and so we're getting out with a lot of private landowners and public land managers to assist with wildlife habitat management. With waterfowl and wetlands particularly, that is involving doing slow water drawdowns and wetland impoundments where we have management capabilities, trying to promote natural vegetation that's beneficial to all sorts of wildlife, but in particular waterfowl that's going to be growing through the summer, producing seeds that are going to be available when waterfowl return here to Mississippi in the fall and winter.
And so, you're not the first person from MDWFP that's talked about working with private landowners. And I from what I gather, that's kind of an important part of the thing. Are most landowners in Mississippi kind of open to the idea of working with y'all?
They seem to be very open with us. A lot of people, we talk with landowners every year who didn't realize that we had this service where we can come out for free and offer what we call technical guidance to those landowners. And we don't try to force our objectives or our opinions on them. We work with the landowner, what they're wanting to set the property up for, what they're already doing, and try to tailor in some recommendations that will help meet their property objectives. Everyone may be a little bit different, but, you know, Mississippi is, by and large, privately owned. 80-90% of the state is privately owned. And so to do our job managing natural resources in the state, we have to work with private landowners to be able to achieve that.
So you talked about how different things throughout the year. What about here in early spring? What is a waterfowl biologist doing about this time of year?
Yeah, so doing some of those what we call moist soil management drawdowns, working on habitat management. A lot of people don't think about that, you know, we just ended winter, you know, some of our waterfowl are still here getting ready to leave or have recently just left on spring migration, and we're already starting to get ready for when they come back, you know, managing those habitats. So it's kind of a never-ending process. There are a lot of people who will, you know, kind of neglect things and then get ready in late summer, early fall to start thinking about ducks returning back here. But we work with a lot of good public and privately owned properties that are working on it right now because they know that they have to have a plan. They have to assess as we go through the growing season to be able to provide quality habitat.
So when we talk about migration for waterfowl, they're here in the cooler parts of the year?
That's right. We start to pick up the earliest migrants that we get as far as ducks are going to be blue-winged teal. They'll start to show up sometimes in August, but generally September, October is the peak times when we'll start to have them passing through. But they don't stay here generally throughout the winter with us like some of our other duck species. They're kind of stopping in very briefly and then moving on to Central and South America on their furthest extents of migration. They're more like a shorebird as far as the extent of their migration. It's really impressive. And then on the flip side, thinking about it in spring, a lot of our winter ducks and geese that stayed here, like gadwall, mallards, snow geese, are well on their way back north on spring migration. And again, here come the blue-winged teal here in the next few weeks. Some people may already be seeing those. They're kind of behind because they're on such a long leg of migration to get back to their breeding grounds. But yes, a lot of the ducks and geese that we winter here in Mississippi, people don't really realize or don't think about that they're spending their summers nesting, raising their broods in the northern U.S. or southern Canada in the prairie pothole region.
So we might think it's cold in the wintertime here, but obviously if you're living up in northern climes, this is sort of a break from the cold.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's one of the cues that they use for migration. You know, a lot of species will use photo period, and as soon as the seasons start to change, they know that, and the day length starts to change, they'll go ahead and migrate. other birds are, like waterfowl in particular, can be a little more cold tolerant, cold hardy. Mallards in particular are like that. And so they'll kind of ride it out, so to speak, and when winter starts to get too much for them to handle or food resources are not available, then they will, you know, migrate south and move on to better conditions.
Are there any waterfowl that are year-round residents of Mississippi?
Absolutely, we do. The state duck of Mississippi is the wood duck, actually, and we have a very strong wood duck population. We also have hooded mergansers, and both of those are getting into the nesting period for those species. And so they're both cavity nesters. People may be out, if they're walking in the spring woods or maybe out turkey hunting, may see wood ducks in particular flying up into trees, you know, looking for natural cavities in trees to be able to nest in. And then people may be very familiar with our Canada goose population. We have a strong resident Canada goose population. Some people enjoy seeing a few of those birds, but don't want to see a lot of them, particularly if they're in a subdivision or maybe spend a lot of time on a golf course. We get a lot of those calls.
A merganser. I'm not sure I've ever heard of that. Tell us what that bird looks like.
Yeah, excuse me. A hooded merganser is a very different looking duck. It's a diving species. They spend a lot of time on permanent water bodies, rivers, lakes, things like that. They get their name hooded merganser because they have feathers on their head that they can actually stick up when they're when the males are courting females. The females have it as well, but you don't see it as prominently. But their bill is very different from most duck species that we think about. People think ducks, and they're not as familiar with different species. May think of a mallard or a farm duck that has a flat and rounded bill. Mergansers are geared and adapted toward catching things like crawfish and fish in ponds. And so their bill is shaped more like, I call them like needle-nose pliers. They're very, very, very different, but they're for a specific purpose for those food items.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're visiting today with Houston Havens. He's the Waterfowl Program Coordinator for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. But let's talk a bit about geese. Are there any geese that are year-round residents of Mississippi?
There's Canada geese. We'll stay around year-round. We have other migratory geese, snow geese, which particularly people in the Mississippi Delta, if you've driven across the Mississippi Delta during the wintertime, may see these really, really large flocks of white geese. Those are primarily snow geese, and Ross's geese will be mixed in with those very, very dense flocks. We also get greater white-fronted geese, or people call them speckle bellies, that'll be here during the fall and winter, but those, for the most part, have moved on back north. They nest in the Arctic, so long way to go there. But primarily the goose species that we're going to have here in Mississippi through the spring and summer are going to be those Canada geese.
And the park that I walk in Pearl has both ducks and geese there. I mean, in situations like that, do they tend to seem to get along okay?
They do get along okay. Canada geese, once they start to nest, will get a bit territorial, you know, toward other animals and toward people sometimes. And we do get those calls during the spring and try to help people out as best we can. They are migratory birds, and so they're protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, even though they're resident populations of those birds here. And so there are, you know, certain conditions and protections that are afforded to them under that. But yes, so this time of year, they're starting to pair off. They're not in really big social groups anymore. That goes for ducks and for geese, even the domestic ducks that you may see on ponds and lakes throughout the spring and summer here. And so they do set up sort of territories. You know, your larger body birds like your geese are going to be more territory defending just because they're adapted to be able to do that. Ducks are not really going to be so much. They're just going to try to be more secluded and hidden in their nesting territories.
Yeah, like I say, when you see some of those geese coming at you, you know to kind of get out of the way.
Sure, that's right.
They are big birds, that's for sure. We'll continue visiting with our guest for the hour. Houston Havens is the Waterfowl Program Coordinator for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. You can email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson. And our guest for the hour, Houston Havens with the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. If you missed any of today's show, you can subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app or download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone. Then you get to listen to all the local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. And if you want to join our conversation this morning, you can always send an email to the show by sending it to animals at mpbonline.org. Got a couple of callers on the line, so we'll start by going to Madison. Tom has called in today. Good morning, Tom. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. I have been a duck hunter most of my life, and most of my hunting was done about 30 years ago. And I remember about maybe 25 years ago, GPS trackers were placed on a lot of waterfowl, and it showed that waterfowl don't simply go south and then north, that they'll go back and forth during the season, depending on weather. I've also seen to notice over the last few decades, we seem to have fewer ducks in Mississippi during duck season. I have a close friend who used to live here, now lives in central Missouri, where he grew up. He thinks they have more ducks now than they did a few decades ago. And it's all that has made me wonder if climate change is having an effect on duck populations, at least during certain times of the year in certain places like Mississippi. And I wonder if there's any evidence to either support that or contradict that.
Sure, good question. Bird movements are certainly tied to weather, and waterfowl are no exception there. There is some research developing, looking at trends from a wide range of studies, whether that's harvested bird band returns or telemetry studies, things like the Harvest Information Program wing surveys through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Some information that would suggest that over the last 20 years or so, waterfowl distributions have shifted a bit north from where they previous were in, you know, say, the period before a couple of decades ago. And so we do think that that is tied to, you know, the differences in temperatures. We're having milder winters the last few years, certainly the last 4 or 5 years. It's interesting because we get a year like we had just this past year where we were extremely mild, extremely dry through most of the fall and winter. And then in, I guess it was mid-January, we just had that extreme cold snap. It definitely proved to waterfowl hunters and a biologist like myself that weather still moves birds, because we had a tremendous influx of waterfowl that responded to that cold snap. They weren't here previously because we were doing our regular surveys throughout the wintertime. And so it's, we would, as waterfowl hunters and as managers for waterfowl here in the state of Mississippi, we, you know, certainly hope that they show up earlier and use our resources, our properties that we're managing for them earlier in the year. But it was still good to see that the weather still moved those birds. They were hanging out in the mid-latitudes or northern latitudes until that had occurred. And it was always good to kind of show that evidence.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. Let's stay on the phone lines next. We're off to Boonville. Clifford has called in today. Good morning, Clifford. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling to see if you have ever seen this before. I witnessed a goose landing on the surface of the water. So whereas normally they would put their feet down first and glide and land across the surface, this one just stayed belly down and literally like a airliner slid across the surface of the water until it came to a stop. I was wondering if that species was familiar to you.
That is a common thing that happens with waterfowl in general. I think sometimes as we get into this time of year, they're doing it as a bit of a display for mates. They do a lot of funny things if you watch birds on the water this time of year, whether it's bobbing heads up and down or the way that they're swimming. Sometimes they'll stick their heads down, you know, right next to the surface of the water and approach a potential mate. With things with species like geese or Canada geese in particular, it could be something like those birds that we were talking about earlier, being aggressive, you know, showing a just kind of a, hey, I'm big and bad, and you know, don't come over here and mess with my territory. You may have a mate close by that is getting ready to nest. So, just some thoughts on reasons why. If you Google some waterfowl photography online, there's a lot of really good photos of birds coming in and landing on the water, just like you described, ducks and geese.
All right, Clifford, thanks for the call. If you want to join our conversation this morning, you can email the show, send it to animals@mpbonline.org. You know, I guess a lot of animals do that showing off, and I guess the males are trying to say, hey, I'm the best of the bunch, so you should mate with me.
That's right. You know, they do that. Ducks in particular do it with their plumage. You know, the drakes are very brightly colored during the winter, and especially into this time of year, because they're trying to attract that mate. But then behavior-wise, absolutely, they're trying to show off things. Species particular things like northern pintail during the late winter, late January, early February, you might see a courtship flock of 7 to 10 drakes following one hen in the air, and they're just trying to stay as close to her as she can. She's kind of putting them through the ringer and seeing how acrobatic they are in the air, and so it's really impressive to watch.
You know, I'm bad about doing this on the show a lot, but I put, you know, like sort of human characteristics or whatever. But like you say, she's probably thinking to herself, well, I'm going to see, you know, which one of these guys is worth his stuff.
Sure. And we always think about wildlife in those terms. You know, we kind of try to anthropomorphize, you know, what they're doing and why they're doing it. And that may not be the reason at all, but it makes sense to us a lot of times.
And it's fun thinking about it, that's for sure. So you mentioned spring migration. How do birds prepare for it? Because as you mentioned, these are some really long journeys that they go on.
Absolutely. So with waterfowl in particular, because of their relatively larger body size compared to shorebirds or songbirds, they're able to pack on body reserves. And so they kind of, so to speak, pack a lunch. And so if we have quality winter habitat that birds can access and use, they will prepare their bodies before they leave for spring migration. Now, of course, they will use stopover habitat along the way and use areas before they get to their final destination for the nesting grounds. But they are geared to be able to basically consume a lot of food, build up those fat reserves and energy reserves so they can travel those long distances.
And when they migrate, it's not, I don't think, obviously the same exact pattern every time, but there is sort of a general area and way that they go. It's important to keep waterways and wetlands accessible for these birds as they make that migration.
That's right. We try to encourage landowners and property managers who have the ability to drain water off of wetlands, because it is valuable for wetlands to go dry temporarily to be able to regrow a flush of vegetation and all. But we try to encourage landowners and land managers in Mississippi to leave that water on, at least until you see waterfowl and other birds stop using them. So if you have ducks that are still using a shallow managed wetland right now, we encourage people to leave that water on until those birds are gone, because that's what they're using it for, is to refuel and to prepare for that migration. And then along the way, we're in the Mississippi Flyway as far as waterfowl are concerned. And so you talked about, you know, using those same corridors for migration. And the Mississippi River is a primary corridor that they're going to travel up as they head north right now and in the next few months. And so those wetlands along the way are also important to be able to conserve those wetlands and have them for birds to stop in and refuel along the way.
Are there parts of Mississippi that are more waterfowl abundant than others?
Yes, the Mississippi Delta is our primary waterfowl region. We have other river drainages like the Big Black River kind of going through central Mississippi, and then on the east side of the state, the Tennessee Tom Bigby Waterway. Those are three primary areas, but the Mississippi Delta, by and large, is kind of the cream of the crop as far as waterfowl habitat and where we see the most abundant waterfowl during the winter.
How far south do they go to get near the coastal areas?
The Gulf Coast, that's a good point. I kind of forgot about that one or left that one out. We have a lot of diving duck species that go all the way to the Gulf Coast. Scalp in particular are birds that are going to use the Gulf Coast, you know, way out. You may see rafts of lesser scalp a mile off of the coast out of the Mississippi Sound, but they're going to use those deeper water habitats and coastal marsh areas.
So if someone had some birds that migrated away from their lake due to a lack of resources, what could they do to make it more available for when the birds return?
Sure. They can give us a call, and we can have a biologist come out and meet with them and take a look at what they've got. I looked at a situation very similar to what you just described last week, And it depends on the capabilities. If you have the ability to manipulate water levels with a water control structure, then that gives you a lot of advantages for managing waterfowl habitat. The idea there being you pull the water down once it starts to get into late spring or early summer when growing conditions are right for quality grasses and sedges that are going to be seed-producing plants by late summer and early fall for waterfowl to consume. Not all wetlands are created equal. You know, a big fishing lake is mostly going to be deep water with a little bit of aquatic vegetation in it. Good for diving ducks, but for our puddle ducks that are going to use much shallower water, not really very beneficial for those. And so it really just depends on the setup and the type of elevations and topography in a wetland as to what it could be really conducive for management for.
Do we know, I'm not sure memory is the right word here, but would these birds, if they found a place that they got what they needed maybe on one migration when they come back, can they maybe search out for that same area?
Yes, site fidelity is very strong with waterfowl, particularly on the nesting grounds. We often see that hens will go back to their natal grounds where they were raised to nest in those same areas in the summertime. But also during the fall and winter, when ducks find, winter is stressful for all birds, but for waterfowl in particular, when birds find areas that they're successful in, we often see that they return to those same areas in the fall and winter. And that can be determined on habitat availability and quality between here and there. Birds are always reading the landscape and making their decisions based on habitat and resource availability.
And so what are some of the conditions that might contribute to birds maybe not having enough food? Overfishing, pollution control, those sorts of things?
Pollution could be because it's impacting the vegetation, the environment, and its response and ability to produce waterfowl foods. I would say that just wetland availability and the proper depth, again, with dabbling ducks, which is kind of what people are generally trying to manage for and attract, those species need quality wetlands that are going to be relatively shallow, 18 inches or less. And so, having wetland habitat availability at a wide distribution, not just on one property, but we talk with property owners all the time who we encourage to work with their neighbors, because having a larger landscape, ducks are responding to a landscape rather than just one particular wetland a lot of times. And so they're highly mobile, they're able to move around and exploit those resources. If you get a big rain, you'll often see birds show up in new areas because they're just really adept at finding those quality food resources. But we want to try to provide as much as we can on a wide distribution as we can to be sure that we're meeting their needs.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're going to take one final break this hour. When we get back, we will finish up our conversation. Our guest today is Houston Havens. He's the Waterfowl Program Coordinator at the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. Dr. Major still on the line. If you have a pet question, you can email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. We're back on Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, and our guest this hour is Houston Havens, Waterfowl Program Coordinator at the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. If you're listening and have a question for us, you can email animals@mpbonline.org. So when we talk about hunting season, it's recreation, good for, the humans, but also it is really a way to control the waterfowl population. If that's correct, when is duck hunting season?
So in Mississippi, our typical duck hunting season is going to be the weekend after Thanksgiving in general, and primarily runs through the end of January. Those peak numbers of waterfowl are typically observed in Mississippi either in early or late January, and so that's kind of the primary time of year when our hunting season is going to overlap.
So what about, I don't hunt, but I guess I think of things like duck calls and maybe decoys or whatever. Do those sorts of things work, or are the birds a little bit smarter than that?
They are very smart, and I think the primary advice I would give anybody who's getting into waterfowl hunting is concealment, camouflage, being hidden. Their eyes are very good, and so that's a large part of it. But yes, decoys and calls, very big part of it. Some people can go overboard, and maybe I've gone overboard a bit from time to time with getting elaborate with decoy spreads and all. But Yeah, that's a very interesting part of hunting, interacting with the birds, calling back and forth, trying to communicate with those birds and provide a very realistic look on the water with a decoy spread is a large part of it.
So we've talked a lot about migration this hour. So what are some of the ways that you as a wildlife biologist sort of track migration?
Yeah, I think you might have had a guest a few weeks ago that talked about banding on this show. We do a lot of waterfowl banding. That is a primary way of tracking migration and harvest rates. We got to get around a lot of really good information from birds on that. So in Mississippi, we band our resident populations of migratory game birds, which is primarily wood ducks and mourning doves. We do a lot of banding during the summertime on those birds. Getting the information back from that is primarily through hunting. When a hunter harvests a banded bird, they have that unique number that they can report online, get the information back on where that bird, when that bird was banded. So it's kind of a trophy, and it's interesting information for the hunter to get back, but it's very valuable biological data for us to know, how long these birds are out there before they're being harvested, what portion of the banded sample, because they're not all being harvested, obviously, what portion of them is being harvested, feeds into harvest rates, things like that. But there's other things like technology is rapidly advancing in all walks of life, but even in wildlife science, transmitters that we're putting on birds, they're continuing to get smaller and smaller, so they're less invasive, less taxing on smaller individuals. And so we get really good real-time habitat use information from those birds. We can put transmitters on ducks in the wintertime and follow them around and see exactly what types of habitat they're using, how they're interacting on the landscape. And then also we see where our ducks are going when they go back north, when they go back to the prairie pothole regions, places like that. There's not always a tower or satellite that can pick them up in those very rare rural regions, but once they come into contact with those satellites, that data is uploaded, and so we get really good detailed habitat use information on that.
And I imagine that the information that you gather from studies of migration and that sort of thing makes the advice and tips that you give landowners even better, I guess.
It does. It's good for that, property management, we might rethink how we want to set up even a public use area to attract more birds. It's also good for deciding where to use money. As a state agency, we have a state waterfowl stamp that Mississippi waterfowl hunters are required to have, and so that money is used to improve, whether it's public land habitat here in Mississippi. We might even use some of that money on research to continue to find out what birds are doing and how we can better manage for them. And then also on the breeding grounds, through studies like either band returns or transmitter studies, where we're seeing where these birds that used Mississippi during the wintertime are going back to, we can direct some of that funding to the breeding grounds to continue to conserve that habitat, because that's what's driving and continuing to produce these populations that we're enjoying.
So the waterfowl population in Mississippi, doing well, struggling? What's the...
Doing well, and we talk about populations. Generally, we're tracking breeding populations on the breeding grounds in the Dakotas and prairie pothole regions. But as far as populations or abundances of birds that are coming to Mississippi, greatly varies, as we've seen in the last few years, depending on weather, depending on habitat availability. Somewhat of a downward trend the last few years because of the mild winters that we've been having. But again, you get a deep freeze where we're down in the single digits, or maybe even North Mississippi might have, zero or negative temperatures. Ducks responded to that, and they definitely came here and used Mississippi wetland habitats during that late winter time.
But I think that's a good point, because we've talked about that sort of in general on the show and other things, and that is if you had a lot of ducks that in your area or whatever one year, and maybe they're not there for a couple of years, don't think that they'll never coming back. It's a lot has to do with the weather.
That's right. A temporal change in distribution is what we would call that. Now, we are certainly tracking breeding populations. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does what we call May pond counts and breeding bird surveys. during actually during May, that's what we call it that. But we get those numbers every year, and so we're able to kind of track what the breeding population is on various waterfowl species, and we adjust hunting regulations and bag limits according to those numbers. So we're, you know, always being mindful that we're not taking too much of a portion of a population through the through hunting.
So we got about a minute left. Is there anything that the average Joe can do to help out and assist the work that you do?
Sure. They can work with us to come out, if they're a private landowner, to come out and give habitat management advice. It's a really busy time of year that we're doing a lot of that, both in our waterfowl program and in our dedicated private lands program. We have biologists all over the state that are, you know, more than happy to come out and work with people that, you know, maybe they don't do anything and they just, you know, have a place. You know, it doesn't have to be a large property. Maybe they just want to say, hey, I have this. What can I do to make it better for wildlife? Any wildlife species, you know, can we can potentially give some habitat management advice to. You know, I'm not I haven't always been a big bird watcher in general, but I've gotten really into, you know, just maintaining bird feeders in, you know, a backyard type of setting. Really encourage people to do that. It will really surprise you the different species that are in your area that will be attracted and that you can learn about just by, you know, putting a bird feeder or two in your yard.
That is going to wrap us up for today. Creature Comforts is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio, with funding provided in part by contributions from listeners like you, and thanks to everyone who made contributions during our drive time last week. If you want to hear today's show or a previous show, you can visit mpbonline.org/radio. Our show is produced by Abram Nanny. So for Dr. Troy Major and our guest Houston Havens, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to stay tuned because up next at 10, it's AutoCorrect. We'll be back next Thursday at 9 for another Creature Comforts, heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.